life, God formed around him the heir of the body and the heir of the soul. Now, we comfortable with the heir of the body, we have to really look at the heir of the soul. The natural heir of the body and the heir of the divine will for the soul. Now, there's another way of looking at the divine will, literally as your ability to breathe and live. So Louisa says, I continue in my state of the privation of Jesus and of intense bitterness for my soul. And if Jesus makes himself seen in passing in my interior, he's all taciturn and pensive. Now, she knows he's only like that when there's problems in the world that need to be fixed. However, in spite of his silence, she said, I am content, thinking that he has not left me and that his dwelling within me still continues. Now, she's come to something that she hasn't said before. Any soul in grace has the indwelling of the Trinity in them. And so once she begins to home in on the indwelling of the Trinity, she's home and dry. The Lord is there all the time. It's just that she's been utterly spoiled in having so many visions and revelations of his. So she said, I am content, thinking that he has not left me and that his dwelling within me still continues. As my poor soul is about to wither, the sight of him gives me a sip of life, and like beneficial dew, it revives me again. But to do what? It's to return to wither and find myself dying again. Now, it's this experience that she has that she's sort of barely coming to life and then is withering again and coming back to life. She needs to understand what's going on, and that's what this text is about. So, I'm always, she said, between life and death. Then when I was swimming in the immense sea of the pain of having lost the Lord, it's not actually possible for her to lose him because she's in grace, and grace is the indwelling of God in us. She means that in an experiential, a tangential way that she has lost him. My sweet Jesus moved in my interior because he's there all the time. The kingdom of God is within. That's Luke 17:21 and 1 Corinthians 3:16. So my sweet Jesus moved in my interior. And since he made himself seen in the act of praying, I united myself with him in prayer. And he said to me, my daughter, in creating man, in order to preserve his life, I formed around him the heir of the body and, of course, within the heir of the soul. The natural heir of the body and the heir of my will for the soul. Now, the moment he uses that language, he's telling us that we absolutely cannot live without the divine will. So before he even goes any further in his argument that he's going to give to us, he's telling us that to live on our own will when the divine will is already inside of us is utter madness. So we now have the heir of the body and the heir of the soul. The natural heir of the body and the heir of my will for the soul. Now, we know we can't live without air. So if the divine will is literally air for the soul, and I try to live in self-will, then I'm self-destructing. It's complete madness. So there is the natural air for the body and the air of my will for the soul. Do you believe that the natural air, only because it is air, has the power of giving respiration to man? And of giving him strength and nourishment and freshness and vegetation to all nature. So, even though it cannot be seen, the air has everything in its power. Because the air enables us to oxygenate, as we would say. And without oxygen, none of our functions can actually carry out. So it has everything in its power. It constitutes itself the life of each created thing. Therefore, everyone feels the necessity of air and follows its course everywhere, night and day. It penetrates into the beating of the heart and the circulation of the blood. Literally, it penetrates into all the cells of the body. But do you know why it contains so much power? Now, my book says virtue, and the screen probably says virtue as well. It does, yeah. But it actually means power. Why has it got this power? Because in the air, there is the whole substance of the goods it produces. The nourishing, the respiratory, and the vegetative strength were placed by God in the air. So we cannot breathe, we cannot function, we cannot do any of our bodily functions without this oxygen, which is absolutely essential to life. So it was all placed by God in the air. And it contains as though many seeds for all the good that it encloses. Now, one of the fascinating things about this text is the multiplicity of images that Louisa uses, even in one sentence. We're talking about air in the lungs, and then she says it contains many seeds. And that's a completely different image altogether. And so what is being said here is that the air has multiple functions inside of us. So therefore, it is the life-giving function. Without air, we die. So watch where this is going. Now, if air was needed for the preservation of all nature, air was also needed for the preservation of the soul. So the air now is the image of the divine will in the soul. And my goodness did not want to entrust or form another air for the soul, but my very will. So the air that we're breathing, and the fact that we have to do it all the time in order to live, and that the air has to be fresh and wholesome, and everything else that you know about air, tells you that if we're not breathing the divine will, if it doesn't constitute the life of our whole being, then in God's eyes, we're dead. You know that beautiful hymn, "Breathe on me, breath of God"? Well, that captures this image. Breathe on me until I am wholly thine, until every part of me glows with thy fire divine. We sing it, we hardly realize what we're actually singing or praying. So, if air is needed for the preservation of all nature, air was also needed for the preservation of the soul. So the air for nature is the symbol for what is needed to keep the soul going, the interior life. And my goodness did not want to entrust or form another air for the soul, but my own very will, what actually keeps the Blessed Trinity going. He gave to us to keep us going as well. My very will wanted to constitute itself the air or the essential element of life for the soul, so that all the substance of the goods that the divine will contains, like air, even though they're invisible, because all the goods that are in the air are also invisible to us. And that's why he's using the image of air, which we're breathing all the time. We know it's essential to life, but we're hardly conscious of the fact that we're taking in so many good things to keep us alive. And he's using that as the image to try and tell us that the divine will is that essential, utterly essential for life. So the divine will, like air, even though it's invisible, might penetrate into the depths of the soul and bring her the divine nourishment. Now you see, the air is bringing nourishment to every cell of the body. And he's trying to tell us that the divine will is bringing nourishment to every part of the soul as well. So, the divine will, like air, though it is invisible, might penetrate into the depths of the soul and bring her the divine nourishment and the vegetation, that means the growth, and all goods. The respiratory, you see the word virtue being used all the time. The word virtue is being used incorrectly in the English language. The respiratory power of all that is in heaven. By respiration, we're taking in all the goods that the air can possibly give to us. So he's saying that by operating in the divine will, that we are taking into ourselves all the goods that are in heaven available to us. And these goods contain the invincible strength and the fruitfulness of all the virtues. There should be a contest, the body in breathing the natural air and the soul in breathing the air of my will. Yet, he says, there's enough to make one cry about. In other words, the divine will is neglected. If creatures feel the natural air lacking, they procure it for themselves by going up high mountains, and they express with sorrow the lack of air. We're in total crisis if the air is very thin or if the air is polluted. But they've not one thought or sorrow for the air of my will. Even though creatures are forced to be as though soaked with the air of my will, in other words, we can't function without the divine will maintaining us in existence. So even though we're soaked with the air of the divine will, because they do not love this balsamic and sanctifying air, it cannot place in the soul the goods that it contains. So if we're to take the natural air outside of us, inside of us, we take it into our lungs, and the goods that are in the air are spread throughout all the cells of the body to give us life and allow the oxygenation that is absolutely basic to all life, not just human life. So he's trying to say to us that we're not conscious of the enormity of the change that will happen when we consciously breathe in the divine will as well. Breathe on me, breath of God. Fill me with life anew, that I may love what thou dost love and do what thou wouldst do. That wonderful prayer that we sing at Pentecost time really is the message of this text here. Breathe on me, breath of God, until my heart is pure, until with thee I have one will to do and to endure. The church has prayed correctly in using that hymn. Now, there's another verse that I can't remember, but it's a very beautiful thing to sing. And it does express the ideas that are in this text. And so we will go anywhere to get fresh air, get good air. We know that it's absolutely essential for life. And he's saying that just as that is essential for physical life, we need the air of the divine will for our spiritual life. And where do we go looking for that? Are we as anxious to have that divine air as we are of the physical air? He said it's enough to cry. So even though creatures are forced to be as though soaked with the air of my will, Jesus says, because they don't love this balsamic and sanctifying air, it cannot place in the soul the goods it contains. We don't open up to it, you see. And it's absolutely essential for us to consciously open up to the divine will and consciously surrender our will to let the divine will take over. It's actually quite difficult for two people to drive the same car with the same steering wheel. One of the great accidents I had in my life was when a person grabbed the steering wheel out of my hands. We ended up in the ditch, I don't have to tell you. You can't have two drivers of the one car. And so when it comes to driving our life forward, we cannot have the human will and the divine will. It's one or the other. So since we don't surrender to the divine will, The divine will cannot place in the soul the goods that it contains, and it is forced to remain there, sacrificed, while being able to carry out the life that it contains. So the divine will has absolutely everything for our lives, but if we don't let it operate, then it's non-functional. And it's not God's fault either. Therefore, my daughter, he said, I recommend to you, if you want my life to fulfill its designs within you, always breathe the air of my will. I think it's a very good exercise to do, not every now and then, but very frequently, to just sit back, not too comfortably, the spine needs to be erect, and to breathe very, very deeply. And as you're breathing, to say, Lord, I want to breathe in your divine will to take over absolutely everything, and I want to breathe out my human will. And do it as very slow breathing exercises, and it'll begin to dawn on you that one has to give way to the other. The two can't drive the car together. So if you want my will to fulfill its designs within you, always breathe the air of my will, so that as you breathe it, the divine life may grow in you. Now, whoever translated this said, vegetate as if we were plants. So that the divine life may actually grow in you, and that it may lead you to the true purpose for which you were created. We've got to go back to the time when Adam actually allowed the divine will to govern his life completely, so he could give complete glory to God. So let's come to November the 27th, 1924. And here we compare two things, the immutability of God, the unchangeableness of God, and the changeableness of creatures. I was thinking about the immutability of God and the mutability or the changeableness or the fickleness of creatures. That's us. Don't think of the four-legged ones. What a difference, she said. Now, while I was thinking about this, my always good Jesus moved in my interior, saying to me, my daughter, look, there's not one point in my being which is not present. He's totally present to us. We can have the experience of being in the presence of human beings, and they're not really present to you. They might be giving you an official response or saying all the right things, but you try and engage them in some kind of real conversation, they're not really present. And the Lord is really present to us. I want to give you Psalm 139, verses 7 to 12. The Lord is present in absolutely everything to us in all of his creation. In fact, one of the things that we have to consider is that he is omnipresent. There is nowhere in creation where God is not present. God is omnipresent. And if he is not there, and if he's not preserving his creation, the whole thing will disintegrate. So Jesus said, my daughter, look, there's not one point in which my being is not present. I've no place where to oscillate, is what the book says. I've nowhere to move, we would say. I've nowhere to move, either to the right or to the left or to the back. It's very interesting that he says this, because when Louisa describes Jesus in the womb of his mother, she also says he had no room to move, which is amazing. I have no place to move, either to the right or to the left or to the back. No empty space which is not filled by me. The whole earth is filled with his glory. Finding not one point in which I'm not present, my firmness feels unshakable. There's no need for him to change. Change is something that happens to us. This is my eternal immutability. This immense immutability renders me immutable in pleasures as well. If he likes something once, he likes it forever. Now, I have to tell you, the Psalms are full of this. And I'm going to give you a whole lot of references from the Psalms, and it's not them all. Okay, just to let you know, if you go into the Psalter, that the message you're reading here is all over the place in the Psalter. Psalm 9, verse 7. Psalm 10, verse 16. Psalm 45, verse 2. Psalm 48, verse 8. Psalm 72, verse 17. Psalm 104, verse 31. Psalm 117, verse 2. Psalm 118, verses 1 to 3. Psalm 119, verse 89. Psalm 135, verse 3. Psalm 136, almost all of it, 1 to 26. It probably is all of it. And Psalm 146, verse 10. That's quite a bit of testimony. So the message that's here is all over the place in the Psalter. And Jesus says, this immense immutability renders me immutable in pleasures. Now, whoever translated this loves big words. In other words, Jesus is saying, if God likes something, he likes it forever. He doesn't change. If God loves you and me, he loves us forever. He doesn't change. What I like, he said, I like always. That's a much nicer way to say it. I am immutable in loving. I am immutable in enjoying, and I'm immutable in wanting. God doesn't change. God is. So I want to give you Hebrews 13, verse 8 there. He does not change towards us either. Can't you see that what he's trying to tell us is that human beings, by comparison, are utterly fickle? That we change with the weather. We can like a person for a while and then we don't like them. We go off them, you know. And we're the ones who can do winters and summers in relationships like everything else, also with the Lord. We can be very fervent in prayer at one time and another time forget altogether to pray. And Jesus continues, once I have loved, enjoyed, and wanted something, there's no danger that I may ever change. So that means that when you go to the scriptures and you read the words, I love you, that's an eternal statement. And it's not based on you being good or bad or indifferent. He just loves you. And I think that when we begin to take things like that on board, that he doesn't change just because we change, that we can reach out for the fullness much better. In order to change, Jesus said, I'd have to restrict my immensity, which I can't do, nor do I want to. My immutability is the most beautiful halo which crowns my head, extends under my feet, and renders eternal homage to my immutable sanctity. Now, this is where he's going, you see. It isn't just immutable beauty you're looking at or anything else. It's the sanctity, it's the holiness, and he needs us to begin shifting in that direction. Tell me, he said, is there perhaps one point in which you don't find me? And as he was saying this, Louisa said, this divine immutability made itself present before her mind. But who can say what I understood? I fear I would only speak nonsense, she said, so I'm going to move on. So in the next section then, he's been talking about his immutability, and then he looks at us, and we can be fair weather friends. We can be like the weather vanes, you know, it's different today and different tomorrow. So the human will is unstable. You can see why he's asking us to hand over to the divine will, which is utterly stable. So in speaking about the mutability or the fickleness of creatures, Jesus said, poor creature, how tiny is her little space. And as tiny as it is, her place is not even stable or fixed. So it jumps about. Raining today, sunshine tomorrow. Or as we say, a friendship that switched on and then switched off and you don't know where you stand, you don't know whether you're on or off today. So as tiny as we are, he said, it's not even stable or fixed. Today she's at one point and tomorrow she's flung to another. This is also the reason why today she likes someone or something or someplace, and tomorrow she changes and maybe even despises what she liked or loved today. We see lots of evidence of that around us. But do you know what renders the poor creature so fickle? Mutable is the word on your page. It is her human will that renders her fickle in love, fickle in pleasures. At one stage we like something and then we go off it, we don't like it anymore. At one stage we say that an outfit is absolutely gorgeous and then we won't wear it. We change like the weather vane. And so it's her human will that renders her fickle in love, in pleasures, and in the good that she does. At one stage we're really fervent in prayer and then we cool off, you know. The human will, Jesus said, is like an impetuous wind which moves the creature at every blow like an empty reed. Now, the reed is Matthew 11:7. So one minute she's moved to the right and then she's moved to the left. This is why in creating her, I wanted her to live from my will, which is immutable. So that arresting this impetuous wind of the human will, the divine will might render her firm in good, stable in love, holy in work. Now, if you have a book and you're reading it as distinct from reading the screen, I would suggest you underline that, because there you've been given a bit of discernment so that you can check the healthiness of your own relationship with God at this moment. Firm in good, stable in love, holy in work. In other words, I'm not on and off all the time. So Jesus continued, I wanted to let her live in the immense territory of my immutability. We are in a process of trying to catch up and get to the point where Adam left off. In other words, we've got to go into reverse before we can go forward. It's incredible. We've got to get back to a place where we can pick up this immutable will of God and stay in it and then go forward in immense directions. But he said the creature wasn't content. She wanted her own tiny little place. That's our independence of God. And you'll see this very beautifully in a very innocent image. When you try to help a small child to fasten their shoes, you can show them how to do it. Then they can't do it. Then you do it. And then they don't want you to do it. And they get upset that you do it. And they try and do it. And they can't do it. And you go round and round and round until somebody has to win the battle as to who's going to tie the shoes. Until the child gets the idea. We're like that. We, meaning the human race, that we want to run the world our way. We want to do everything our way, and we make a hell of a mess all the time. And we just have to come around as a race to let God's will do it. He alone knows how to do it properly. The creature wanted her own tiny little place and rendered herself the amusement or plaything of herself and of others. These are the tragedies that we have in relationships, the tragedies that we have in nations, the tragedies that we have in families. And she rendered herself the slave to her own passions as well. So this is why I pray. I supplicate the creature. In other words, God, our creator, is praying to us, not the other way around. It's absolutely amazing. It's upside down. I supplicate the creature to take this will of mine, to make it her own so that she may return into that immutable will from which she came. And then from then on, you go forward. She may return to that immutable will from which she came, so that she may no longer be fickle, but she will be stable and firm. Now, in this text, you should really go over it by yourself afterwards. Very good examination of conscience. I won't do it for you. It's in the text. And then Jesus said, I have not changed. God doesn't change. His will is immutable. And I wait for her. I long for her. I want her always in my will. The wonderful image that's there is the father of the prodigal son waiting for the son who has wasted all his money, wasted all his opportunities, destroyed his health, got himself into ferocious trouble, and is now a complete down and out. And God is still waiting, waiting to receive him home, to dress him again as a son of God, and to start him off on the journey again. And so we have here a wonderful invitation to us to come back to the original plan that God had. So we continue this message now in December the 1st, 1924, how the divine will rejected by creatures feels the death of good. That's all the good that we could have done if we were in the divine will. So Louisa said, I was feeling embittered to the summit. And while I was praying, I cried over my hard lot of being without the one who formed the whole of my life. Now, she says, without the one who forms the whole of my life, that is a complete impossibility. If God moves from us, we simply cease to exist. There wouldn't even be anything to bury. We would simply cease to exist. The scripture tells us that in him we live and move and have our being. So when Louisa says, I am without the one who forms my whole life, she's saying, I don't see him, we're not talking, he's not giving me, externally giving me the strength that I feel I need. So she's talking very humanly there. She's not actually talking theologically. My state is irreparable, she said. No one is moved with pity for me. Now, the no one includes the Lord and the angels that should go to the Lord and tell him her trouble and the saints who should be interceding for her and everybody else. Nobody will have pity on me. Everything is justice. Now, why is she making this comment? Has she forgotten that she's a victim soul? The victim soul stands between the justice of God and the sinfulness of the human race and prevents too much of that justice from going on to the human race because the victim soul does all of the terrifying part of the penance, so that only a small part of it will go to the ones who actually deserve it. She knows this theoretically, but she's feeling so awful that she talks as if, you know, it's different. And then she said, who would be moved to pity for me if the one who is the source of my life denies it to me? So in the second paragraph, and one of the things I love, someday somebody will have to do the relationship between Jesus and Louisa. It is, excuse me for using perfectly ordinary word, I think it's divine. I think it's fantastic. And that's what I mean by divine. I think it's really fantastic. So here's Louisa looking for pity and understanding. And then Jesus comes along and he shows her off to all of heaven. Look at the only one on the planet Earth who really, 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 really wants me. All the others say they want me, but they're doing their own thing. It's fantastic. He has found one who really can't do without him. And that's an incredible thing for him. So, while I was crying and praying, Louisa said, I felt my hands being held between the hands of Jesus. You see, he hasn't gone anywhere. And raising me up high, he said, come, all of you, come and see something that is so great and it has never before been seen in heaven or on earth. A soul dying continuously out of pure love for me. Louisa doesn't realize that she has become the tremendous lover on the earth, and that she's literally dying out of love and need for him. She can't see it. She only knows the pain and the agony and the need. That's all she can see. But the Lord is looking down on the earth at this one person who loves him to distraction and can't be without him. And she disintegrates if he doesn't turn up. I mean, what do you mean, lover? I mean, she's incredible. So Jesus invites all of heaven, the angels and the saints, all the dwellers in heaven to come and have a look at this one person who loves them to distraction on the earth. At these words of Jesus, the heavens opened and the whole celestial hierarchy looked at me, she said. I wouldn't like the whole hierarchy of the church to look at me, let alone the whole hierarchy of heaven. And Louisa said, I looked at myself. I don't know what they saw, but I looked at myself and I'm a wreck. I just love it. It's fantastic. Louisa can't see at all what others can see. I looked at myself, she said, and I saw a poor soul withered and dying like a flower which is about to bend over its stem. And while I was dying, a secret power was given to me. And it gave me life. Ah, maybe this is the punishing justice of God that punishes me justly, she said. My God, my Jesus, have pity on me. Pity this poor dying one. Mine is the hardest lot among all other mortals, to die and not be able to die. It's absolutely fantastic. It's really true that we cannot see ourselves objectively. What she sees and what the Lord sees is two entirely different things. Then for almost the whole night, my sweet Jesus held me in his arms to give me strength and to assist me in my agony. I want to give you Luke 22:43. When Jesus was in agony in Gethsemane, the Lord sent an angel to him to help him in the decisions he had to make and to give him strength. Also, I want to give you the Song of Songs, chapter 2 and verse 6. His right hand is around me and he embraces me. Okay. So there in the first two paragraphs, you would think she's far away from God. And here she has this extraordinary experience of intimacy. You see, you can't see yourself objectively. Louisa said, I thought he would finally have compassion on me and would take me with himself. No way. This is only volume 17. There's 36 volumes. She's not even halfway through the revelation that he gave to her. Not even halfway through. If she knew that herself, she mightn't have been able to cope. So, I thought he would finally have compassion on me and would take me to himself, but in vain. After he cheered me somehow, she said, he left me, saying to me, my daughter, my will is receiving continuous deaths on the part of creatures. This is all the refusal of human beings with their sinfulness to let God have anything to do with their lives, particularly people living in mortal sin. The divine will is life. And as life, it wants to give life and light. Now, for this little part, you need to read John's Gospel, the first two paragraphs in the prologue, the life and the light. So the divine will wants to give the life of light. But the creature rejects this light. Now, if the creature rejects this light, it means that it wants to live in the darkness of its own puny little setup. We like independence from God. And we've made such a hell of a mess of human history you'd wonder, doesn't anybody think there must be another way? My daughter, my will is receiving continuous deaths, he said, on the part of creatures. My will is life. And as life, it wants to give the life of light. But the creature rejects this light. And because she does not receive it, the life dies in the creature. Now, if you're talking about light, the opposite is darkness. If you're talking about life, the opposite is death. So light is the presence of God illuminating us. Darkness is the self-will and sinfulness taking over and us demanding to run the world by ourselves. Okay. So the life of the light, and he wants us to live by his light and by his life. And therefore we will be living a life so much superior to everybody all around us. But the creature rejects this light because she does not receive it. Now, to receive it means to take it into your very being, your soul, and to let it become life for you. The creature rejects this light. But we go to the television looking for all kinds of stuff. We go to the internet looking for all kinds of stuff. We go to anything that's human. There is a spirit hovering around, trying to make sure that we don't go to the true source of life and light. The creature rejects this light that God gives, and she does not receive it. So when she really rejects it, the light dies for that person. That's very frightening, that the light of God would die in me. That would mean I would live in drastic interior darkness. And my will, he said, feels the pain of the death which the creature has given to this light. So when people go into sinning in a very grievous way, they are killing the light and they're choosing the darkness. My will wants to make known the qualities and the virtues that it contains. But the creature rejects this knowledge with the qualities and the virtues that it contains. Okay. The Lord wants to give us divine knowledge, which he does in the scriptures and in these writings and in the writings of the other saints and mystics. Human beings want to reject this. They don't want to have this knowledge. And if they reject it, then they have to stay on a very low level of just the body and the senses, and a lot of sin. My will wants to make known the qualities and the virtues that it contains, but the creature rejects this knowledge with the qualities and the virtues that it contains. And so my will dies for that creature. What does it die to? It dies to this knowledge. That means that a person can reach a point where they're not even able to know there is a God. They're in such interior darkness. They're not able to know truth. And they'll go chasing after falsehood. And he says, the creature can die to the qualities and the virtues of the divine volition. Now, for the section I've read, I want to give you John chapter 1. Verses 4 to 9. That's the prologue I've pointed out already. I want to give you John chapter 3, verses 19 to 20. I want to give you John chapter 8, verse 12. I want to give you John 11, verses 9 and 10. John 12, verses 35 and 36. Because in John's gospel, he speaks a lot about life and light. God is life and God is light. So when you talk about the life of light or the light of life, you're talking about the same person. And so Jesus said, my will feels the death, the pain of the death that the creature has given to the virtues and qualities of his will. It's difficult for us where we're at to really see the damage that is done when we go down the route of self-will and darkness and sin. It's difficult for us to appreciate that. It's difficult for people who are ill to go to hospital and for a doctor to sit down and give them a detailed description of what is wrong on the inside of their bodies as well. They can't believe that all of this stuff has gone awry. All they know is that they feel awful. And all that a lot of people in the world feel is that they're desperately unhappy. And that there must be something somewhere. And so they go chasing around the world looking for phantoms. They think that the next holiday or the next adventure or the next whatever, that will bring them the happiness. And nothing does, because they're looking in the wrong place. And we find that the more we seek God's will and the more we open up to letting God's will work in us, the more his grace flows in us and through us, and the more settled and peaceful we are, and the more we enter a little bit deeper and deeper into all of these wonderful qualities that he speaks about that are his. So, Jesus said, in the same way, if the divine will wants to give love and it's not received, it feels the death that is given to love. Thirdly, if it wants to give sanctity and grace, it feels the death that the creature actually imposes on it. And so the divine will feels the continuous death of the good that it wants to give. So the more we reject what the divine will is offering to us, he experiences a death. The death is that something stops. Some living thing stops. And then he said, don't you feel within yourself the continuous death that my will suffers? Now, he's beginning to alert Louisa to what is actually happening to her, because she goes through these states and all she knows is the awful pain and disintegration and everything else. And then he comes along and he gives her a revelation and explains that this is what you're experiencing. So he said, aren't you experiencing this continuous death? Well, Louisa thought that that was just because he wasn't coming. And he wasn't behaving like he was before and staying with her for hours and having a wonderful time. Not at all. That she's entering more and more deeply into what he is experiencing as well, what the divine will is experiencing. By living in the divine will, he said, you are forced, as though naturally, to take part in these deaths which my will suffers, and to live in a state of continuous agony. So the deeper you go into the divine will, it isn't just the love and the holiness and the grace that you touch. The divine will is the essence of God. So you will also touch what he is feeling with regard to creatures and what creatures are doing. So while we're on the earth, it's not actually possible to be out of suffering. You only reach that point when you go into the eternal side. So by living in the divine will, you are forced, as though naturally, to take part in these deaths which my will suffers, and to live in a state of almost continuous agony. On hearing this, Louisa said, Jesus, my love, it doesn't seem to me that it is so. It's your privation that kills me. Now, she has a fixation on that. And he is continuously trying to tell her that there are other reasons for what is happening to her. It's your privation that kills me and that takes life away from me without letting me die. And Jesus said, the privation of me on the one hand and my will on the other, which keeping you absorbed within itself, makes you share in its pains. You're actually experiencing the pain that human creatures are giving to God all the time, because the divine will is the essence of God. My daughter, he said, in the true living in my will, there's not one pain that my will receives from creatures which it doesn't share with the soul who lives in it. Now, those of you who are getting serious about this stuff, I suggest that you take out those last two lines, write them on a different sheet of paper, and really look at them and say, oh my God, is that where we're going? And the answer is yes. You enter the divine will. You take the divine will into yourself. And what he has is shared with you. My daughter, in the true living in my will. So notice there's a difference between being on the periphery and actually entering right in to let the divine will run everything. In the true living in my will, he said, there's not one pain which my will receives from creatures which it doesn't share with the soul who lives in it. Therefore, it's not possible really to have the divine will without pain. This is the crucifixion for us, as it was for Louisa. And we've got to ask ourselves, A, do I love God enough to go further into this? And do I love the human race that has no idea what it's doing to itself and where it's going and what the end product is of the horrendous decisions that it's making? Am I prepared to let them all die? Do I just want to enjoy myself with the Lord? No, we have to say yes to this. And on earth, it comes with pain. In heaven, it comes with glory. It's wonderful. Look at the humility of God. He shares everything with us. And who are we? We're absolute nothings, and yet he will share everything with us. It's incredible. Let's come to December the 8th. We have an absolutely extraordinary piece here in December the 8th. And it's on the Immaculate Conception, the test which the Holy Virgin had to go through. Louisa said, I was thinking about the Immaculate Conception of my Sovereign Queen Mother. Sorry, I don't do the mama bit, I can't stand it. The qualities, the beauties, and the prodigies of her Immaculate Conception poured into my mind. A prodigy which surpasses all other prodigies done by God in all of creation. Now, while I was thinking about this, I said to myself, the prodigy of the Immaculate Conception is great, but my celestial mother had no test. It's very, very interesting that she goes down this route. If she had no test, she's utterly spoiled. Everything has been given. And she's going to discover that's not the way it is. Our celestial mother had no test in her conception. Everything was favorable to her, both on the part of God and on the part of her nature, which was created by God so happy, so holy, and so privileged. So, where was her heroism and her test? If the angels in heaven were not exempted from the test, and Adam and Eve were not exempted from the test, why was the queen of all alone to be exempted from the most beautiful halo which the test would place on her head of queen and mother of the Son of God? Very good question. And what's happening there is that the Lord is getting her to ask questions that we would ask, and particularly people who would not have studied the Marian theology and wouldn't have looked into all of this. So these would be questions that lay people would ask. Not sure if Louisa would want to ask a question like that all by herself, but the Lord guides her to ask the questions so he can make the revelation for the rest of us. Anyway, the answer is everybody is tested. The Lord does the work of creation. The human creature has to decide whether they want God or not. So, Louisa said, as I was thinking about this, my beloved Jesus moving in my interior told me, my daughter, no one can be acceptable to me without the test. Look at it. That includes you and me. Nobody. Nobody. Had there been no test, I would have had a mother who was a slave, not free. And slavery doesn't enter our relations, and it doesn't enter our works, nor can it be part of our free love. Now, the problem with the translation is that modern human beings have a different interpretation of free love. They consider it completely immoral with no rules whatsoever. So we have to be careful sometimes that the translation, we need to understand what he's actually saying. So if we are to have this wonderful relationship in heaven with him, then we have to be tested. It's like saying, if I want to take an aircraft off the ground and take it anywhere, no airline would dream of doing it unless I was tested to see was I airworthy. Anyone who would let me do it and I wasn't airworthy, they would not just be foolish, they would be murderers because everybody would be killed. And so the test is terribly important. And of course, it's one of the first things you meet in the Bible is God testing. I gave you this. What do you want to do? Will you come my way? Because if you have free will, there's two ways. My daughter, he said, no one is acceptable to me without the test. Had there been no test, I would have had a mother who is a slave, who is not free. And slavery does not enter our relations and our works, nor can it be part of our free love. My mother had her first test in the very first instant of her conception, which is beyond my imagination. I don't know about yours. As soon as she had her first act of reason, notice that first, she knew her human will on the one hand and the divine will on the other. Now she's in a different place to the rest of us. So far in my long life, I am the only person I've ever met who remembers being in the womb. I've never met another person who remembers being in the womb. So if she was consciously able to make decisions in the first instance of her being, you're talking about something that is so extra special that it's in a world by itself. As soon as she had her first act of reason, she knew her human will on the one hand and the divine will on the other, and was left free to choose one of these two wills. Without losing one instant, that makes her exceptional beyond exceptions. Knowing the full extent of the sacrifice that she was making in the first instant of her being, that's beyond my capability of understanding. Without losing one instant, knowing the full extent of the sacrifice she was making, she gave us her will without wanting to know it ever again. Now, the problem with us who are on the ground floor, maybe you're a few flights of stairs beyond me, but those of us who are on the ground floor can find that you don't even know you're doing your human will, and you just have to keep remembering to bring the divine will into it. But to give your human will away at the first instant of your being is beyond amazing. So she knew the full extent of the sacrifice that she was making. She gave us her will without wanting to know it ever again. And we gave her ours as a gift. Now, notice that her will has been surrendered and she releases it back to God in the first instant. And so she has the divine will from the very first instant of her being. So she's in the same position as Adam, given the divine will at her creation. So this is the beginning of the recreation of the human race. And in this exchange of donation of wills on both sides, The difference is that we don't have this in Adam as well. And in this exchange of donation of wills on both sides, all the qualities, the beauties, the prodigies, and the immense seas of grace poured into the Immaculate Conception of the most privileged of all creatures. A case on her own, nobody to compare with. It is always the will that has to be tested. It's the will that's held accountable by God for all our actions. So it's what is done with the will that matters. We're inclined to think that what happens in the emotions is terribly important, and that if I forgive somebody, I have to be able to forgive them with my emotions. Initially, it is extremely important to realize you forgive with your will. You love with your will. Everything's in the will. The body follows afterwards, like the carriages on a train. So it's always the will that I am used to testing, the Lord says. All sacrifices, even death without the will, would nauseate me and would attract not even a glance of mine. But do you want to know what the greatest prodigy was which we worked in this creature so holy, as well as the greatest heroism of this creature so beautiful, which no one will ever be able to equal? She began her life with our will, and so did she continue her life, and did she complete it. So, is she in a different position to Adam? Totally. She never took it back. So she sacrificed her human will for her entire life. So it can be said that she completed from the point where she started. Because you know from former messages that we have read that the divine will is a single point. Everything is in that single point, that singularity, as the scientists say. So it can be said that she completed from the point at which she started, and that she started from the point at which she completed. So it's a single point. It's a singularity. And our greatest prodigy was that in each one of her thoughts, in each one of her words, in each one of her breaths, in each one of her heartbeats, in each one of her movements, and in each one of her steps, our will poured upon her. Now, I kept repeating that statement so that the power of it would come across. Our will was poured upon her, and she offered us the heroism of a thought, a word, a breath, a heartbeat, divine and eternal. Just think about the little girl, Mary, doing this. I think it's completely divine. So this divine will was operating within her, doing this wonderful stuff. So I want to give you Psalm 52, 6 and Psalm 8, that she was divinized through the divine will. So our Protestant brethren who don't understand her, don't understand this mystery and don't accept it. They know nothing about this. This, Jesus said, raised her so high that what we are by nature, she was by grace. So the Protestants tell us that we exaggerate and that we make her out to be something she isn't. It's because they don't know about the divine will. All of her other prerogatives, her privileges, her very immaculate conception would have been an absolute nothing compared to this great prodigy. Now, all the others that everybody considers completely amazing, totally once off, almost inexplicable, he says it's nothing by comparison with this. all you can do with this, I think, is pray it line by line. I don't think anybody giving a commentary could do justice to this. So all of her other prerogatives, her privileges, her very immaculate conception would have been an absolute nothing compared to this great prodigy. Even more, this is what confirmed her and rendered her stable and strong. Now, in the early messages this evening, we have been described as unstable and not strong. And you see that the divine will makes a person stable and strong. And the more that the divine will takes over, the more stable and the more strong we become. So I'm giving you that as a key to discern how you're doing in the divine will, because you'll see this transformation in yourself. You'll see your character and your personality being transformed. Others will as well. So he continues, my continuous will pouring upon her made her share in the divine nature. Now, those words are written in the book. And if you want to look this up, 2 Peter 1:4, the Lord wants to divinize us. Look at the humility of God, wanting to make other creatures and lift them as high as we will agree to go. So my continuous will pouring upon her made her share in the divine nature, because there was a divine will operating in her, not a human will. The human will was set aside. And her continuous receiving of the divine will rendered her strong in love, strong in sorrow, distinct from everybody else. It was this will of ours operating in her that drew the divine word upon the earth, that formed the seed of the divine fecundity to be able to conceive a man and God without human intervention. I mean, this is as clear as daylight, isn't it? And made her worthy to be the mother of her very creator. Now, notice the divine will is what transformed her human nature and everything in her so that she is able to allow God to be God for her and within her. And therefore, she's able to allow God to do what he wants in her and through her. Now, that is the challenge that the Lord is giving to all of us who are trying to live the divine will grace on the earth today, to let him transform us as much as it is possible for us to say yes, so that he can use us as the answer to the present generations and restart the church with the divine will reigning at its very heart. What his plans are fantastic, and yet he's only using little people like us. So, this is why Jesus said, I always insist on my will, because it preserves the soul beautiful, that is, as it was made, as she came out of our hands. And it raises her to the original copy of her creator. Now, you need to take this off the page and really look at it. He doesn't want us to be a copy of everything else out there in society. He wants us to be the original copy of our creator, so that even people looking at us, we will remind them of God. You don't have to say anything. They're looking at the original thing. If I see an incredible painting of some master, I don't need to be told it's a master painting. I just want to admire it and know instantly it's a master thing. Human beings looking at us will know that we are being reformed into the original image that God wanted. As many great works and sacrifices as one might do, he said, If my will is not present in them, I refuse them. This makes me very sad because it means an awful lot of work done by good people in the church will have their works refused by God because it was for themselves. They were reproducing themselves or making themselves great. I refuse them. I don't recognize them, he said. It's not food for me. And the most beautiful works without my will become food for the human will, for self-esteem, and the greed of the creature. So, ultimately, we're being told we either worship God or we worship ourselves. I think you and I know the answer to that one. So let's take December the 24th, 1924. And this is another extraordinary one because it's talking about the pain that Jesus actually experienced in the womb. Pain of death, he said, was the first pain that Jesus suffered at his conception and which lasted for the whole of his life. In the incarnation, God placed himself at the mercy of his creatures. How frightening. So, my days are ever more sorrowful, Louisa said. I'm under the hard press of the hard privation of my sweet Jesus, which is upon me like a deadly iron to kill me continuously. For that, I want to give you Psalm 86, verse 3, that she's going through a living death, or as St. Paul says in his writings, 1 Corinthians 15:31, 2 Corinthians 6:9. Paul says he was dying daily. That's exactly what Louisa experiences as well. I also want to give you Luke 9:23. But as it is about to arm the last blow in order to finish it, Louisa said, it leaves it suspended above my head. And I await the last blow like a relief to go to my Jesus, but I wait in vain. That's 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 to 5. St. Paul had exactly the same experience. But St. Paul actually wrote something that Louisa hasn't written yet. And that is that St. Paul said that he wanted to go and be with the Lord. He said, I want to take off this tent and go to be with the Lord, he said. But I have to stay here to do his will, to finish the mission. And Louisa hasn't said that yet. So Louisa said, I felt my poor soul and also my nature, that my body, being consumed and melted. Ah, my great sins do not make me deserve to die, she said. What pain, what a long agony. Oh, please, my Jesus, have pity on me, she said. You are the only one who knows my harrowing state. Do not abandon me. Do not leave me at the mercy of myself. Now, that last line is actually very important because it's a statement. Do not leave me at the mercy of myself. Do you see it there at the end of the page? That is extremely important. And whenever we are in a crisis, we should say to the Lord, please don't leave me at the mercy of myself. Release me from the mercy of myself so that I can actually do your will. The mercy of myself is that I will get caught up in the problems. I will get caught up in the pain. I will get caught up. And then I'm looking at self. I'm not looking at him. So while I was in this state, Louisa said, I felt I was outside myself. What a relief for her. Within a most pure light, which of course is the divine will. And in this light, I could see the Queen Mother and the little baby Jesus inside her virginal womb. Oh God, she said, what a sorrowful state my little baby Jesus was. His little humanity was immobilized. Now, usually babies have plenty of room in the womb. His little feet and hands were immobile. So I want you, if you have your book, to write on it, his first prison. The eternal, immense God confined in a tiny space. For him, that would be completely suffocating. when he has all eternity and even the immensity of the universe isn't big enough for him. To be confined in this tiny space of a woman's womb must have been horrendous. There was no room, she said, either to open his eyes or to breathe freely. His immobility was such that he seemed to be dead while he was alive. I thought to myself, who knows how much my Jesus suffers in this state, how much his beloved mother suffers in seeing the baby Jesus so immobilized in her womb, because we all know that the baby needs to move for health. So, while I was thinking of this, she said, my tiny little baby sobbing said to me, my daughter. Now, I love that. She's talking about a tiny infant still in the womb, and the tiny infant is calling her my daughter. I just love that. Louisa completely forgets the symbols that she's using. My daughter, he said, the pains I suffered in this virginal womb of my mother are incalculable to the human mind. The reason is that he is the infinite, ever-living, everlasting God. That the entire universe can't contain him. The entire universe is small to him, his immensity. And here he is, locked up in this tiny, tiny, tiny space. Utterly, utterly claustrophobic, utterly suffocating. He said it's incalculable to the human mind. But do you know what the first pain was which I suffered in the first act of my conception? Now notice that in these messages tonight, we're going back to the first things, the very earliest things. The first act of my conception, and which lasted for the whole of my life, was the pain of death. The earth gave him death, and he came to give us life. My divinity, he said, descended from heaven and was fully happy. It was untouchable by pain. And it was untouchable by a death. Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 to 10. When I saw my little humanity being subject to death and pain for love of creatures, I felt the pain of death so vividly, because there's nothing in him to stop him feeling this pain. I felt it, he said, so vividly, that I really would have died of sheer pain if the power of my divinity had not sustained me with the prodigy. Now, this means that the pregnancy could not have been comfortable for our Blessed Mother. Because if he's going through this level of pain inside of her, that is communicating to her as well. The mother becomes very conscious of the child in the womb and what the child is actually experiencing. I really would have died of sheer pain, he said, if the power of my divinity had not sustained me with the prodigy, making me feel the pain of death and the continuation of life. Now, what do you think he's saying to Louisa? This is exactly what you're experiencing in the privation. You are feeling the pain of death and still life continues for you. I'm trying to tell you that you are living a mystery inside of yourself, which you can't see objectively. You will only understand it fully in heaven. I felt the pain of death so vividly that I really would have died of sheer pain if the power of my divinity had not sustained me with the prodigy, making me feel the pain of death and the continuation of life. So for me, it was always death. Now, when you consider that Jesus is life, what the earth gave him as soon as he arrived was death. That's what the earth has produced with its sin, is death. The gift of earth is death. The gift of God is life. I felt the death of sin, he said. I felt the death of all good in the creatures, and I also felt their natural death. What a cruel torment this was for me during the whole of my life. No wonder he had so much compassion on people who suffered. I who contained life itself and was absolute lord of life itself was to subject myself to the pain of death. I want to give you John 14, 6, 1 John 5, 11, 2 Timothy 1, 1, and Acts 3, 5. So he who is life came to us, we gave him death, that's all we had. And he came to overcome that death and to give us life eternally. Now you know who we are and you know who he is. Don't you see my little humanity immobile and dying in the womb of my dear mother? And don't you yourself feel within yourself how hard and excruciating is the pain of feeling oneself dying without dying? So he's trying to explain what Louisa is going through and what she's been complaining about in the last couple of messages. He's giving her an experience of what he went through, but she's experiencing it as an adult. He's experiencing it as an infant in the womb, which is, there's no comparison. My daughter, he said, what you're experiencing is you're living in my will that makes you share in the continuous death of my humanity. So, Louisa said, I spent almost a whole morning close to my Jesus, inside the womb of my mother. Now, there's a miracle for you. And I saw that as he was in the act of dying, he would regain life, which is what she has been describing of herself in the last number of messages that I've shared with you. He would regain life and then abandon himself to dying again. What pain to see the baby Jesus in this state. Now, in our celebration of Christmas, we're inclined to put the baby Jesus very comfortable and all the rest of it. And the reality of him coming into the world was very different. Then after this at night, Louisa was thinking about the act in which the baby Jesus came out of the maternal womb to be born into our midst. Her poor mind wandered within the mystery so profound, and a mystery that was all love. And she said, my sweet Jesus, moving in my interior, stretched out his little hands to embrace me and said to me, my daughter, the act of my birth was the most solemn act of the whole of creation. There's another one to take off the page, write it up on their fridge or something so that you'll keep looking at it. We need to really look at this because we have made Christmas out to be such an innocuous little feast that it doesn't even impress the children anymore. We need to tell them the truth. We need to start telling people the truth. He said, the act of my birth was the most solemn act of the whole of creation. Heaven and earth felt plunged into the most profound adoration at the sight of my little humanity, which kept my divinity as though enclosed within its walls. So, in the act of my birth, there was an act of silence and of profound adoration and prayer. Now, don't forget this is happening in heaven as well as in the crib. My mother prayed, and she remained enraptured by the power of the prodigy which was coming out of her. Saint Joseph prayed, the angels prayed, all of creation felt the strength of the love of my creative power being renewed within them. All felt honored and received true honor because the one who had created them would make use of them. For what was needed for his humanity? The sun felt honored in giving its light and heat to its own creator. It recognized the one who had created it, its true Lord, and made feast for him and paid him honor by giving him its light. The earth felt honored when it felt me lying in a manger. It felt touched by my tender limbs and exulted with joy with prodigious signs. All creation saw their true King and Lord in their midst, and feeling honored, each one wanted to perform its office for me. The water wanted to quench my thirst. The birds with their trills and warblings wanted to cheer me. Can't you hear the rounds? The wind wanted to caress me. The air wanted to kiss me. All wanted to pay me their innocent tribute. Only men, ungrateful as usual, even though all of them felt something unusual within themselves. That's a very important statement. Only the Lord could actually tell you that, that on the night that he was born, that all human beings felt something unusual. Because after all, God was visiting the earth in a way that had never happened before. So they felt something. Only men, even though they all felt something unusual within themselves, they felt a joy, they felt a powerful strength, they were reluctant to give God praise. They suffocated everything and they didn't move. Now, notice that all the creation and all the creatures who had the divine will fixed in them gave glory to God, and the ones who had free will refused to do it. That's what you're being told here. And even though I called them with tears, he said, with moans and with sobs, they still wouldn't move except for a few shepherds. So the poor come in from the beginning. Yet it was for man that I was coming upon the earth. He wasn't coming for the stars. He made the stars for man. He wasn't coming for the sun, the moon, the birds, the winds, or anything else. They were all made for man. I was coming to give myself to man, to save him, and to bring him back to my celestial fatherland. Therefore, I was all eyes to see whether he would come before me in order to receive the great gift of my divine and human life. The incarnation was nothing less than placing myself at the mercy of the creature. We all know from what human beings are like, that that's the worst thing you could possibly do. In the incarnation, I placed myself at the mercy of my dear mother, which was okay, as I was born. Saint Joseph, too, was added, to whom I gave the gift of my life. And since my words are eternal and not subject to ending, the divinity, this word, who descended from heaven, never withdrew from the earth so as to have the occasion to give himself continuously to all creatures. Well, I want to give you Sirach chapter 2, verse 22, the very last verse. Let us fall into the hands of God, not into the hands of men, because as great as he is, so great is his mercy. But falling into the hands of men, you get the terrifying treatment that Jesus got: rejection, persecution, torture, death. Incredible. I also want to give you John chapter 1, verses 12 to 14 as well. So, as long as I lived, Jesus said, I gave myself in an unveiled manner. So anybody who wanted to see would in fact be able to see. Now, if you read the writings of Maria Valtorta, you get enormous insight into the incarnation and life and death and resurrection of Jesus. And you can see that it was the poor, that it was the innocent children, it was old people, wounded people. They were the ones who could see. Either their age or their woundedness was the thing that actually helped them to break through to this mystery. So I gave myself in an unveiled manner, and then a few hours before dying, I made the great prodigy of leaving myself in the Holy Eucharist, so that whoever wanted me could receive this great gift of my life. Notice, whoever wanted me. I paid no attention either to the offenses that they would give me or to their refusals to receive me. I said to myself, I've given myself. I do not want to withdraw ever. Now, here you are looking at eternal, infinite, inexplicable love. Look at the next sentence and weep. Let them do whatever they want. I will always be theirs. I will always be at their disposal. There's infinite love and infinite vulnerability. We can take the sacred host and we can desecrate it. He's not going to stop us. I've given myself, I don't want to withdraw ever. Let them do whatever they want with me. I will always be theirs. So if you take that off the page and write it up, put it on your fridge where you can see it, then you will never, ever, ever doubt that he loves you beyond your ability to understand. Daughter, Jesus said, this is the nature of true love, of the working of God. It has firmness. Now, the dictionary says stable, settled, enduring with strength. Okay? So I like the stable. It has firmness. And not to withdraw at the cost of any sacrifice. So he gives himself, and regardless of how we respond, he still gives himself. It's love beyond comprehension. This firmness in my works is my victory. And it is my greatest glory. And this is the sign to know whether the creature really works for God, whether there is firmness and true self-gift in them as well. So here we have our model. The soul looks no one in the face, neither pain, nor herself, nor self-esteem, nor other people, even though it may cost her life. She looks only to God, for love of whom she set out to work. So what he's saying here is that we have to imitate him in our service to God and humanity, that we keep all eyes on Jesus, we look only to him, and that we give ourselves with abandon so that he can do as much as he can to save the rest of them. I think it's a brilliant idea. Not being firm is of human nature and of the human way of working. And not being firm is the working of the passions, and with passion. Mutability, you see, is the exact opposite of his firmness and immutability. And so the dictionary says that mutability is that you're changeable, fickle, inconstant, irresolute, and unsettled. And I kept all the words because I think they all fit. So if we're changeable, fickle, inconstant, irresolute, and unsettled, then of course we're going to have weakness and cowardice, and there's no way we can understand true love, no way at all. Therefore, firmness must be the guide in working for me, he said. So in my works, I never change. Whatever the events might be, once it is done, it's done forever. My dear friends, I think the only thing you could do with these readings tonight is pray. I think it's absolutely brilliant. So I want to finish by doing a little prayer. O Lord Jesus, we fuse ourselves in your most holy humanity, in your divinity, and in your most holy will. And with your holy will, we want to take your power and wisdom, and we want to make them our own, so that we can prostrate before your supreme majesty on behalf of all human beings, past, present, and future. We want to adore you with your own adorations. We want to bless you with your own blessings. We want to love you with your own love. We want to thank you with your own thanksgivings, and we want to repair you with your own reparations. Holy God, since your power, wisdom, and love communicate directly with the powers of the soul, the intellect, the memory, and the will, so you will hear the echo of your own adorations and praises coming through us. Holy Father, with your will, I want to repeat this prayer for an infinitude of time and bring it to infinity as well, so that you will be loved, adored, blessed, praised, and thanked by every human being from Adam to Zachary. Holy Father, with your will, I want to adore and love you. May God be praised and glorified forever through all his creatures and in all creation. Amen. Good night, everyone. God bless.